Good evening and welcome to the KRFP Evening Report, special Friday edition for November 11th, 2016. On today's show, we'll hear from Western Lands Project founder Janine Blaylock, who has fought the collaborative processes for public lands, she says leaves the interests of the public and wildlife behind. But first, this news. U.S. Department of Agriculture soil microbiologist Ann Kennedy has studied 25,000 species of naturally occurring soil bacteria in an effort to find a few that stop cheatgrass root growth. Helicopter crews are now spreading those bacteria over 3 square mile sites in southwestern Idaho in an effort to get a handle on the invasive cheatgrass, which cheats native plants out of their water and dries out in the summer, leading to massive wildfires in the southern Idaho desert. The experiments are part of the Interior Department's order last year to implement science-based solutions to protect sage-grouse habitat, as well as 300 other species that depend on the sagebrush ecosystem. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service recently declined to put sage-grouse on the endangered species list, but will review the ground-dwelling bird's status in 5 years. Biologists say only 200,000 to 500,000 sage-grouse remain in their 11-state range in the western U.S., down from a peak population of 16 million. Sagebrush-fueled fires have been particularly devastating to habitat in the Great Basin that includes parts of Idaho, Nevada, California, Utah, and Oregon. U.S. Geological Survey research ecologist Matt Germino said, "We hope that we can identify the effectiveness of the bacteria on annual grasses and to identify non-target risk effects. It's unlikely that any one technology will be the magic bullet. Cheatgrass has come to dominate our lands. Chances are there are fundamental problems in the health of the land or how we are treating the land." A grand jury has indicted 44-year-old David Earl Hutto for first-degree murder, first-degree kidnapping, robbery, and first-degree arson for the killing of Northwest Specialty Hospital X-ray technician William Bo Kirk on October 22nd. Kootenai County prosecuting attorney Barry McHugh says Kirk acted with premeditation after some sort of road rage incident and shot and killed Kirk after Kirk left a shift at the hospital in Post Falls. McHugh said Hutto took Kirk's pickup truck, debit and credit cards at gunpoint. He also says Hutto set Kirk's truck on fire on Rimrock Road in Coeur d'Alene the same night. Kirk's body was found in the Coeur d'Alene National Forest October 25th. Federal police arrested 36-year-old Justin Roy Booth of Hayden October 28th in connection with the case. Hayden had lived with Hutto. Court records say Booth has cooperated with investigators and given them information on his and Hutto's involvement in Kirk's death. A Washington State University student in Pullman discovered hate messages on his car yesterday morning. WSU student John Krause found the messages written in large letters in red paint on his white Kia, which included the words "die faggot fag" and "go to hell" just before his morning classes began yesterday. Krause told Pullman police he first tried to erase the messages, and when he returned to his car after class, he found about 20 people buffing the words off. Krause believes the vandalism is related to the presidential election, which occurred Tuesday, which has had the effect of normalizing bullying against minorities and other repressed groups. After the incident, Krause wrote on his Facebook page, "To all, this is what Donald Trump's America looks like. Consider this my call to arms against hate." According to the Daily News, Pullman police said they don't believe the words are related to Tuesday's presidential election. Washington State University violence prevention educator Katie Noble posted pictures of the words painted on Krause's car on Facebook and received hundreds of comments. The investigation continues. Portland police have declared yesterday's protest against President-elect Donald Trump a riot. Protesters carried signs saying "No racists, no hate," and "Revolt." In a Twitter news release, the Portland Police Bureau decided to designate the protest as a riot because they say the incident brought extensive criminal and dangerous behavior into the area, pointing to increasing reports of vandalism and aggressive behavior. The Associated Press reported at one point people were throwing objects at officers and a car at a dealership. Several news organizations posted videos and pictures of the damage, which included broken and smashed out windows. A second video showed one confrontation in which a woman threw laundry detergent at the protesters. Police responded with rubber bullets and some tear gas towards the protesters. Police officials asked residents to stay away from the area if they do not want to be associated with the protest. They advised people they could face felony riot charges if they remained in the area. Oregon Transportation Department officials closed a portion of Interstate 84 and Interstate 5 for a period of time as a precaution. They urged drivers at the time to watch for people in unexpected places on the roadway. Pullman School District Superintendent Bob Maxwell has urged local residents to tell state politicians how they feel about the 2012 Washington Supreme Court McCleary decision, which requires the legislature to fulfill its constitutional duty to fully fund basic education in the state. Maxwell addressed about a dozen people after a tour of some of the district's schools. He implored them to think about the importance of funding, saying, "If we don't take action this legislative session, I'm really afraid of what's going to happen to public education. We can't just keep delaying it, delaying it, delaying it. I've been in business for a long time, and I'm tired of things being moved down the road so it's somebody else's issue when it affects our kids here and now." During the tour, district officials, including teachers and principals, stressed the need for basic funding and what the implications might be if those needs are not met. Sunnyside Elementary principal Pam Brandner warned about challenges other districts are facing around the state. Brandner said, "Pullman is not immune to those challenges. Despite the new facilities at Pullman High School and the newly approved Kamiak Elementary School building," Brantner said, "the state of Washington and the nation, it's just in a crisis level. In 2009, there were 691,000 teachers in teacher preparation. In 2014, that had dropped to 451,000, so we're at a 35% shortfall. Currently, there are 60,000 positions that have gone unfilled in the nation. They predict by 2018 that will increase to 160,000 unfilled positions, which of course is scary for us." Maxwell said the district has a shortage of teachers because of a low salary problem, which can be fixed by implementing the McCleary decision structures. Maxwell said, "Our kids deserve that, and if we don't do something about teacher compensation in this state, we are going to continue to have to fill classrooms with, frankly, teachers that have great hearts, but they may not even be certified in the content they're teaching. That's not okay." Seattle Mayor Ed Murray said Wednesday, "Seattle will continue to be a welcome place for immigrants and will continue to function as a sanctuary city that will shelter undocumented immigrants." Murray said sanctuary city status will stand even if it means Seattle will lose federal funding. Murray was reacting to the Electoral College's anticipated election of Donald Trump as president. Speaking of Trump, Murray said he has demonstrated outright misogyny and racism and authoritarian tendencies. Trump had said earlier in the campaign he wants to build a wall along the border of Mexico and ban new Muslims from coming to the U.S. Montana voters this week approved a ballot initiative repealing the severe restrictions on medical cannabis in the state. Authors of the initiative intended to quickly do away with a law passed by the legislature that went into effect this summer that limits cannabis providers to a maximum of 3 patients, effectively outlawing dispensaries. Montana voters approved medical marijuana in 2004, but since then, the legislature has severely restricted dispensaries and access to medical cannabis. Because of an error in drafting the initiative which passed this week, the restrictions will remain in place until July 1st of next year. The initiative that passed this week also got rid of a narrow list of ailments that can be treated by medical cannabis and a system which flagged physicians who prescribed cannabis to more than 25 patients. The initiative adds post-traumatic stress disorder as a condition that can be treated with medical marijuana. Officials at the Seattle Police Department have fired Officer Adley Shepard for punching a handcuffed woman in 2014. Police Chief Kathleen O'Toole said Shepard violated department use of force policies and de-escalating policies for confrontations. The Seattle Police Officers Guild says if Shepard requests an appeal of the firing, they will file one. Video shows Shepard, who responded to a report of a woman arguing with a man, putting a handcuffed 23-year-old Mieko Durden-Bosley into a patrol car and Durden-Bosley kicking in Shepard's direction. Shepard then punched Durden-Bosley in the face. A Clearwater County Sheriff's Office news release reports police arrested six people this week at a suspected drug house in Orofino, according to the Lewiston Tribune. A drug investigation between the Sheriff's Office and the Orofino Police Department served search warrants in the 100 block of Alpine Drive. Police were searching for methamphetamine and related paraphernalia. Police say they arrested 42-year-old Marilyn P. Halbert of Lewiston and 53-year-old Gary T. Paul of Orofino, 56-year-old Michael D. Ravenberg of Spokane, 30-year-old Aaron C. Sherrard, and 55-year-old Donnie R. Sherrard for frequenting and possession of drug paraphernalia. Police also arrested 30-year-old Melanie R. Hopper for giving false information as well as the frequenting charge. Clearwater County Detective Mike Dietrich said additional charges are expected based on test results of items sent to crime labs. And we now turn to our featured segment. On Saturday, the Moscow-based environmental group Friends of the Clearwater presented its highest annual honor, the McFarland Plaque, to Western Lands Project founder Janine Blaylock of Seattle. Blaylock has fought collaborative processes for public lands, she says, leaves the interests of the public and wildlife behind. Friends of the Clearwater Board Secretary Steve Paulson made the presentation to Blaylock.
To sign this plank is an honor. The people signing this plank have sacrificed, personally and professionally, to work for protecting our commons, wild lands, biodiversity, natural processes. None have received adequate recognition for their important work. I'd like to think that someday when all the natural lands around here are protected and the grizzly bear is roaming free and the wolverine is large populations and the caribou are back all the way down to Chamberlain Basin, that this will be what people look back and remember, the people who actually did the work to make that happen. On the plank is Gary McFarland, Stuart Brandberg, Larry McLeod, Barry Rosenberg, Fred Robbie, George Nakus, Liz Sedler, Jeff Jewell, Karen Coulter, Keith Hammer, and Janine Blaylock. Janine Blaylock earned a degree in environmental studies from the University of Washington with a self-design program focusing on public lands management and policy. She worked for 8 years as an environmental planner in public and private sector. In 1985, she started donating her time to this work. And in 1997, she founded the Western Lands Project, which she has just retired from this year, this within months, I believe. And the mission, bringing reform to obscure federal land exchange programs. The project eventually expanded its focus to encompass the myriad forms of public land privatization. Jeanine also has been a vocal critic of the national environmental establishment, of collaboration, of quid pro quo wilderness, and the government's destructive public land solar energy project.
That was Friends of the Clearwater Board Secretary Steve Paulson. Here's Western Lands Project founder Jeanine Blaylock and her comments at the Friends of the Clearwater annual meeting at the 1912 Center on Saturday night.
Thank you so much. We dissolved the Western Lands Project on September 1st for reasons that I will explain forthwith. I'm not retiring. I'm actually looking for a job. But I have some remarks that I prepared as part of a project to sort of outline the history of the 20 years that I ran the Western Lands Project, and so I want to share that with you. But I want to say first that there could be no greater honor to someone who loves public lands than to be honored by Friends of the Clearwater. And I truly mean that. I have worked with Gary McFarlane and Brett Haverstick and others affiliated with FOC for many years. And these were the people that I always knew I could count on to hold the right position, to support me when I was holding a hard line and being criticized for it. Who respected me as a woman activist, which is not something that's very common in the environmental sector, I have to say. And knowing that Friends of the Clearwater had this incredibly strong community behind it, a very close-knit community of real public land believers, just made it that much more rewarding and gratifying to me that I got support and that I got to work with these people. So you do me about the best honor I can think of as I try to figure out where I'm going next. And I just want to read you a few thoughts about the last 20 years of trying to prevent privatization of public land.
And I'm going to have hot flashes if I'm going.
Guaranteed. In 1996, I was an Earth Firster and Forest Protection volunteer, recently laid off from my job writing environmental impact statements for a consulting firm, and in possession of a self-designed bachelor's degree in public lands management and policy I had known would never serve any practical purpose. Friends from the tiny town of Greenwater, Washington, came to alert our militant Audubon chapter about the Huckleberry Land Exchange, a deal between Weyerhaeuser and the Mount Baker Snoqualmie National Forest that would privatize large swaths of public forest on the hillside above their town. In our preoccupation with the spotted owl and the accelerated shredding of old-growth forests, federal land trades were an issue of which we were all only vaguely aware. The local Sierra Club was assuring fellow forest activists that this one was a great deal for the public and, in fact, had helped engineer the land exchange. I volunteered to look at the Huckleberry Project for Pilchuck Audubon, by the way, a very litigious Audubon group and very admirable. I very quickly regretted that we had allowed these projects to fly by us unexamined, because this project was truly abominable. In order to consolidate ownership of checkerboard lands, the company would trade 30,000 acres for about 5,000 acres of national forest. The secret behind the lopsided numbers was that land trades are based on appraised value rather than acreage, and about 90% of the Weyerhaeuser land coming to the public was rocks, ice, clear cuts, and plantation seedlings. and the public land going to the company was mature and old-growth forest. While poring over the Weyerhaeuser deal, I also explored the larger context. Across a huge swath from Montana to Washington, the Forest Service was systematically consolidating ownership in the railroad checkerboards by way of land trades involving tens of thousands of acres each. The formula was generally to hand off large acreages of public trees in exchange for cut-over industry lands, essentially resupplying timber companies that had liquidated their own forest lands and taking over damaged, densely eroded lands. In the desert southwest, the Bureau of Land Management was on a land trade roll with developers, mining companies, and ranchers. In Nevada, developers were acquiring desirable conservation land around Lake Tahoe they could trade for developable land in the Las Vegas Valley. And there were land trades in Florida, Michigan, Virginia, virtually anywhere there was federal land. For me, the salient outrage of the Huckleberry Exchange was that the Forest Service was trading away habitat of the federally listed northern spotted owl that would be quickly liquidated by Weyerhaeuser, rationalizing it with a blithe assertion that the Weyerhaeuser moonscape that we were getting in return would provide owl habitat in about 250 years. Pilchuck Audubon decided to challenge the project. After losing in the Federal District Court in 1998, where the judge leaned heavily on the fact that the Sierra Club had supported the exchange, we decided to file an appeal in the Ninth Circuit. In the meantime, I found the support to put together a nonprofit called the Western Land Exchange Project and began monitoring all of the land trades. The agencies had been accustomed to getting these projects through with little or no scrutiny. When curious members of the public inquired about a project, they were told that it was a done deal, no matter where in the process, and they were encouraged to believe that its complexities were beyond them. The agencies ostensibly acted under the National Environmental Policy Act, but they treated the trades as simple real estate transactions and rarely analyzed or disclosed the environmental impacts of privatizing federal lands. For example, that forest lands would be clear-cut, desert springs would be buried under mining tailings, or habitat would be replaced with acres of subdivisions. Many projects were blatant giveaways involving powerful landowners or corporations. Land managers were often overly compliant, outgunned by the private proponent's lawyers, or in some cases simply nonchalant about protecting the public interest. With just two staff to cover a vast territory and a perplexing knot of issues, we had to be strategic to achieve our long-term goal of reform. We challenged the agencies at both their national and field office levels. We enlisted media coverage. We met with members of Congress from the public lands committees, and we raised awareness to build pressure for reform. Our cause got a huge boost when a meeting with the Seattle Times editorial board led to a year-long investigation of federal land exchanges published over 5 days in 1998 and in a series called Trading Away the West. It kicked off the paper's investigation of the Huckleberry Land Exchange, found to be a multilateral, multi-million-dollar ripoff. The following spring, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals decided in favor of the Huckleberry plaintiffs, citing violations of the National Environmental Policy Act, and ordered the Forest Service to redo its analysis. The court's decision had an almost immediate effect as the federal land agencies adopted new NEPA procedures for land trades to respond to the court's findings. Thank you. We met with key members of Congress and staff handling public land issues to alert them to the problems with land trades. In time, Representative George Miller of California called on the General Accounting Office to conduct an audit of federal land exchange programs, and the report published in July 2000 was a blistering critique of both the Forest Service and BLM programs. Yet we knew that Congress itself had a big land exchange problem. Legislators enjoyed using their state's public lands to reward favored constituents, and each year dozens of land trades were effected through legislation with little or no public knowledge and no need to comply with environmental laws. These too became part of our work. The final pillar of our strategy was public awareness, bolstered by our educational and outreach efforts, and most significantly by media coverage. Where once the agencies had been able to expect little or no public involvement, grassroots organizations and regular people were now following land trades and calling on us for help. And we and they were challenging trades through outreach campaigns, administrative appeals, and litigation. By the early 2000s, the BLM and Forest Service were making their processes more transparent and instituting reforms in response to both the GAO findings and the widespread media attention the projects were getting. We had exposed several congressional land exchanges in the media and had helped stop one of the worst, the Utah's San Rafael Swell land trade, with the help of a BLM whistleblower. We also helped uncover corruption in Interior's appraisal process, leading to a total restructuring that sequestered appraisers from political pressure. Between 1999 and 2009, we faced a series of insults we called quid pro quo wilderness. Congressional bills that combined wilderness designation with a plethora of non-wilderness provisions, including exchanges, sales, and even giveaways of federal land, designed to buy support from anti-wilderness constituents and legislators. The bills were partially engineered and fully supported by a smattering of environmental groups that had grown impatient with grassroots wilderness campaigns and had been encouraged by major funders to seek this more compromising approach. These bills proposed to privatize tens of thousands of acres of public land with no environmental review and often for free. This created not only a terrible precedent, but a political nightmare with the likes of the Wilderness Society sanctioning privatization of public land. With many grassroots colleagues, including longtime wilderness activists who spurned the quid pro quo approach, we were able to create a groundswell of opposition, and none of the bills were able to pass without being gutted of their most egregious provisions. Thank you, Gary. Our work had its disheartening aspects, including lingering malfeasance in the land agencies and the ongoing cycle of privatization schemes coming through Congress, but none compared to the disillusionment stemming from the actions of the Green establishment, the national environmental groups that so drastically turned away from public land protection for the sake of political and financial expediency. Thus, it should be no surprise that the last challenge of the Western Lands Project that we would take on would be the solar industrialization of our desert public lands, a linchpin of the Obama public lands policy, championed by the Wilderness Society, Sierra Club, and other D.C.-based Greens. Western Lands Project and our colleagues in Solar Done Right were some of the pitifully few exposing the fallacies of industrial solar and the duplicity of the green enablers. The dissolution of the Western Lands Project in September 2016 was a bad news, good news combination of factors, including diminishing funding prospects and a dramatic downturn in the number of land sales and exchanges coming out of the public land agencies. Yet it was critical to ensure that our mission was carried forward, and we were fortunate to find a home for the work and our Western Lands Project staff attorney, Chris Krupp, at Wild Earth Guardians. Our legacy will go forward with Chris, with our three published books, and with the scores of newborn activists we came to know who were spurred into action by a threat to public land that they loved. In many respects, the Western Lands Project accomplished what any founder would dream of, working herself out of a job. But while much reform has been achieved in the land agencies, and quid pro quo wilderness has a very bumpy ride, and congressional land deals get the attention they deserve now, there will always be more work. At its most basic, it is to continually and passionately defend both the ideal and the manifest reality of the value of our public lands. Thank you.
And that was Western Lands Project founder Janine Blalock of Seattle. She was being presented with the Moscow-based environmental group Friends of the Clearwaters annual McFarland Plank Award last Saturday at the Friends of the Clearwater annual meeting at the 1912 Center in Moscow. Well, that's it for the KRFP Evening Report for tonight. Weather for the Moscow Pullman area, 30% chance of rain after 4 a.m. Increasing clouds tonight, low 47. 40% chance of rain tomorrow, mainly before 10 a.m. Cloudy, gradually becoming mostly sunny, high 57. Southwest winds 5 to 15, gusts up to 25. Partly cloudy Saturday night, low 42. Increasing clouds Sunday, high 55, 50% chance of rain Sunday night, mainly after 10 p.m., cloudy, low 45, and an 80% chance of rain Monday, high 53. If you want to help KRFP keep newscasts like this on the air, plus the newscasts you hear during Morning Mix, the recordings of local events, and the public affairs shows, plus the music and arts programming you hear every day on KRFP, be sure to become a member of KRFP. Memberships are $35 a year, $20 for students and low income. You can mail your memberships to KRFP, 114 East 3rd Street, Moscow, Idaho, 83843. That's KRFP, 114 East 3rd Street, Moscow, Idaho, 83843. Or you can go to the KRFP website to find out more ways to help KRFP. I'm Lee Robartis. Jim Roach assisted with tonight's newscast. Have a pleasant evening. This is KRFP Moscow Pullman, community radio for the Palouse at 90.3 on your FM dial and online.